Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel Moth, and I'd like to welcome you to the third session of the Engineering for Multi-Core track. As you can see, there are three more sessions after this one, so I'd like just to bring your attention to those, the times and the rooms that they're at. After this session, you can go and learn how to test parallel and concurrent code. Then you can go and learn how to analyze the performance and visualize what your application is doing inside, so you can get great insights. And finally, how to prevent concurrency bugs at compile time. So three exciting sessions coming after this one. But obviously, you're here for this one, and this is the one where you learn about how to take advantage of parallelism using .NET 4 and Visual Studio 2010 by Stephen Taube. So Stephen has been at Microsoft for over 9 years. He started as a consultant in MCS and then a technical lead in MSDN, and currently he's a program manager in the Parallel Computing Platform. Prior to Microsoft, he gained a bachelor's and master's in computer science from Harvard and NYU, respectively. Something you wouldn't have guessed about Steve when I asked him to share something that people wouldn't know is that he played a small acting role in the Hollywood film Mona Lisa Smile, along Julia Roberts. And I didn't believe that, so I verified it for myself. It is true. It's a very small acting role that he had in there. So with that, I'd like you to please put your hands together and welcome Stephen Taube.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. I know it's rough to get started with these things immediately after lunch, so I'm going to do my best to keep this high energy so that we don't all fall into food comas, including myself. One of the common questions I'm asked when talking about the new parallelism work in .NET 4 is, how do I get started with my own applications? And this morning, for those of you who attended Joe Duffy's talk, he talked a lot about parallel patterns kind of in the abstract and using them to architect your applications. I think that's also a great way to figure out how to actually apply parallelism in the real world. If you understand what parallel patterns are and how they're implemented, and then you understand your application's construction and how it might map to those parallel patterns, you can then more easily figure out how to go from your application to an actual parallelized implementation. So we're going to, with only 40 minutes, we're going to spend pretty much all of it in Visual Studio talking about a few key patterns. Some of them Joe alluded to, some of them he didn't. There is well more than we can talk about in 40 or 45 minutes. So if you're interested, up on the Parallel Computing Dev Center, I have a paper, it's about 120 pages long, that covers a wealth of patterns, including the ones we're talking about today, but many, many more, and a lot of code as well. So if you go out and get Joe's book, and you kind of get the holistic view of concurrent programming on Windows, and then you want to dive more into parallel patterns, you can take a look at the paper. And so with that, I think we'll switch back over to Visual Studio and spend as much time as we possibly can in VS 2010. So the first thing I want to talk about, the first pattern I want to talk about, Joe also alluded to, is around embarrassingly parallel patterns. If you look at concurrency frameworks or parallelism frameworks, this is one of the patterns that's most commonly represented, both because it's very prevalent in real-world applications, but also because it's embarrassingly easy to implement, hence the name embarrassingly parallel. Although, as Don McCready said in his previous talk on parallelism in C++, there's nothing embarrassing about it. If we had more of these problems in the world, we'd be in a much better space. And as a result, I prefer delightfully parallel or pleasantly parallel or conveniently parallel or anything besides something that has this negative connotation associated with it. So as an example of this, we're going to start with one of the first demos we actually built for .NET 4, which was a parallelized ray tracer. And I'm starting with a ray tracer not because it's something that I expect a lot of folks to actually build in their daily jobs, but because it is an embarrassingly parallel problem, meaning that we can basically every individual component of this rendering of this ray-traced image can be done independently. So here I've got maybe a 600 by 600 pixel image, and every single one of those pixels is generated by, in effect, firing a virtual ray of light and seeing what in my 3D world it refracts off of and through, following it as it bounces around and generating a color for that pixel based on the images that it hits. And I can do every single pixel independently, and thus I can parallelize across all of my pixels. Now, you'll notice here that I'm running sequentially. If I bring up my task manager, we can see that I've got a quad-core box here. I'm using almost exactly 25% of the CPU for one core. And I'm getting about 1.1 frames per second. Now, I do have this magic parallel button in my UI the goal being that when I click this, I want to actually run parallelized. Of course, at the moment when I click this, you see I'm getting the exact same frame rate, and that's because in my code, I've marked this as a to-do, you know, one of those infinites. So I'll come back and deal with this later. So let's do that. Now, I'm going to forgo for a moment the parallelism support we have in .NET 4 and actually show how an embarrassingly parallel pattern implementation might take effect. So we're going to actually implement our own parallel loop right in front of your very eyes, and hopefully it compiles and runs OK. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to represent our parallel loop with a static method that goes from some value, in this case an inclusive value, to some exclusive value. And for each thing, we're going to, for each iteration, we're going to run a delegate. If I were implementing this sequentially, I would simply loop from, you know, I equals from while I is less than 2, call body on I. But if I'm doing this in parallel, now I need to start paying attention to my environment. So the first thing I need to do is figure out how many processors I actually have. And .NET has this capability with environment.processorCount, which returns the number of logical processors in the box. It's great. So now I know how many things I can target. I need to spread my work around across those cores. Now I need to figure out how much work I actually have. Well, I'm going to, for the purposes of this demo, just ignore kind of boundary checks and things like that. I'm going to say, in error conditions, my total work is my 2 minus my from. So if I'm going from 0 to 5, I have 5 iterations, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and hence 5 minus 0. So now I know the amount of work. I know how many processors I have. I'm going to split this up into chunks where the chunk size is just the range divided by the number of processors. So if I was on a quad-core box and I had 8 iterations, I would put 0 and 1 on one processor, 2 and 3 on another processor, 4 and 5 on another processor, and 6 and 7 on yet a fourth processor. All right. So now I'm going to distribute this work. So we'll go from p equals 0 while p is less than numprox. And I'm going to take advantage of the thread pool to spin up one work item for each of these partitions that I care about. And inside of my work item, I'm going to do that same sequential operation that we saw that I referred to earlier. We're going to go from some starting value from some starting value while I is less than some ending value plus plus and execute the body of the loop. Of course, the compiler is now telling me I have no idea what start and end are, so we need to fill those in. My starting value will be the beginning of that statically partitioned range, which is just the partition that I'm on times the size of the range. So if I have 8 iterations and I'm on a quad core, this would be 0, 2, 4, and 6. Then I need to figure out what my end of my range is. Now, it would be nice if it was just the start plus the chunk size, but I'm going to deal with one boundary condition here, and that's if my range isn't evenly divisible by the number of processors. For example, if I was on quad core and I had 10 iterations, I don't want to, it's not, 10 isn't evenly divisible by 4. I can't put 2.5 iterations on each partition. So I'm just going to put the remainder on the last one by saying, if this partition is the last one, so numprox minus 1, then go to the ending value. Otherwise, do that whole 2. Otherwise, go to the same start plus chunk that we saw earlier. All right, now we're almost done with our custom parallel loop here. However, I'll call out that we're utilizing another common parallel pattern here, or at least half of one, and that is the fork join pattern. So with fork join, you fork off a bunch of work to be done. It all happens in parallel, and you join the results back. I've handled the fork here by queuing up a bunch of work items, but I'm missing the join. So my loop is going to start. It's going to spin off 4 work items, and then the parallel 4 is going to immediately return without really having done any of the work. So I need to wait for it. I'll do that by using a manual reset event. And in addition to my manual reset event, I need to keep track of how many partitions are actually remaining in my remaining to complete. So we'll say num remaining starts out at numprox, but every time one of these workers completes its assigned chunk, we'll atomically decrement that count, so num remaining. And when it's 0, i.e., when we hit the last one, we'll set this reset event, and then we'll wait for this guy. Now, just to call out another common pattern here, when we're dealing with fork join, with joins, it's very common that you want to keep track of some number of outstanding operations, and you have something that's blocking, waiting for all those operations to complete. When we were developing .NET 4 and we came across these patterns that kept emerging over and over and over, we tried to encapsulate them as much as possible. So instead of to demonstrate that, instead of using a manual reset event and maintaining my own count, I'm going to use the new .NET 4 countdown event. So we'll change this to CE. Countdown event. And we're going to initialize this with the number of signals that we're expecting, which is the number of processors. And then instead of calling our own atomic decrement and signaling this thing, instead we'll just signal that primitive directly. And we'll change this to ce.wait. So now, again, I've got a countdown event that's initialized with a number of remaining signals. And as the workers complete, they'll signal this, and we'll be off and running. OK, so now I have my parallel 4. Now I need to go and remove my to-do here and swap out my sequential 4 with a parallel 4. So I'll say parallel 4, going from 0 to screen height, y, and get rid of my for loop. And we'll close off this loop, which is effectively a method call that takes as its body a delegate representing the work to be done for each iteration. And if I've done this correctly, it'll compile and run. Again, if I run this sequentially, we see I'm getting 1 frame per second. If I now switch over to my parallel implementation, magically, we are getting a better frame rate. Yeah, so our implementation is working. We can visually see it. Instead of 1 frame per second, we're getting somewhere between 2 and 3 frames per second, depending on what else happens to be going on in my machine on this time. So it's nice. But this is a quad-core box. You would hope that I'd be getting closer to 4 frames per second and taking better advantage of the machine than as we see here. Now, the moral of this story is don't implement your own parallel loop. There are a lot of intricacies to doing so, and there are a lot of things you can get wrong. And so I actually want to take advantage of another kind of pattern, which is a visual pattern, to actually see what may be going wrong in my application. And to do that, I'm going to take advantage of a new tool that's in Visual Studio 2010, a concurrency profiler, where I can visualize the behavior of a multi-threaded application. Now, if you're interested in this in detail, Hazem Shafi is going to be doing 2 talks after mine in this track. He's going to be doing a lot of focus on this tool and how to improve the performance of your parallel applications using it. I'm just going to do a brief look at it to see if I can figure out what might be wrong. So I'll run sequentially briefly, and then I'll switch over to my parallelized implementation, and I'll shut this down. Now, as I was doing that, what happened was the tool in Visual Studio asked Windows and asked the operating system to turn on event tracing for Windows, or ETW traces. And in particular, it asked it to turn on events for things like context switches, when threads were being blocked, and so forth. And now the tool is going through, it's downloading symbols, it's mining all that data in order to figure out what my application was doing and provide me with several visual representations of what my application was doing during its lifetime. As we'll see when this comes up, the first representation is a look at, over the lifetime of my application, how much CPU was being utilized. So you can see here, I've got time on the x-axis. I have a number of logical processors on the y-axis. And you can see here is my sequential run. And then over here, where I'm taking advantage of more than one processor, is my parallel run. Now, already, if I zoom in on this, we can see that something odd is going on here. There's this telltale stair step pattern. And when you see this, immediately think load imbalance. But I'll drill in a little bit further to just one of these and look at my threads. We can see here I had a bunch of threads that were partaking in this operation. But some of them appear to be blocked red for a lot longer than they were running green. And in fact, this guy, if we think of this as being my loop, this guy spent only about two-thirds or a half of his time actually executing, and then he ended up blocking. Whereas this guy up here ended up spending the majority of his time. And this is in a single rendering of a frame. You can see how much of my CPUs was actually wasted as these threads were sitting around twiddling their thumbs. The reason for this is if I run the ray tracer again, just so you can see the picture, if you remember how I described ray tracing, where we're firing off rays and rays are bouncing around off of objects, well, when I fire off rays at the top of the screen up here, they don't hit anything. They go off into the void. They immediately come back with the answer of black. But when I fire a ray down here, they start bouncing off of the floor. They bounce off of the spheres. They're doing a lot of additional computation to figure out how these rays are bouncing, averaging the colors together, and so forth. And there's a lot more work. So if one thread is assigned this first quarter up here doing the static partitioning, and another thread is assigned this bottom piece down here, this guy is going to finish immediately and then go get some coffee and whatever else, waiting for this bottom guy to complete. So in implementing my parallel loop using this kind of common pattern of static range partitioning, I haven't dealt with this ability to load balance what we're actually very imbalanced workloads in the body of the delegate. So to deal with that, I'm going to add one character, which is my period, to actually switch over to the .NET 4 parallel class. This is system.threading.task.parallel, which happens to have a method on it called 4. And now if I run with the actual one built into .NET 4, again with the sequential, we see I'm getting one frame per second. And with the parallel, we see I'm getting closer to the 4 frames per second that we were actually expecting. And if I go and look at the task manager, we see, sure enough, I'm close to maxing out this box as a result. All right. So did I mention we're going to go quickly? We're going to move right along to the next pattern, because I do only have 40 minutes. So the next thing I want to talk about is pipelines. So again, Joe alluded to this morning. We have our embarrassingly parallel patterns. But sometimes you have kind of producer-consumer patterns where you have some set of operations that are generating data, and you have some set of operations that are consuming data, and there's a natural dependency between them. So the producer producing data generates something that the consumer consumes, and the consumer can't process it until the producer is done with it. So there's this natural dependency, and you end up with a classic parallel pattern around generating producer consumers, such that while the producer operating on data one, or rather while the consumer can't process data element one while the producer is generating data element one, the consumer can process data element one while the producer is generating data element two. And the consumer can process two while the producer is generating three, and so forth. And so the more stages you have in these producer-consumer pipelines, the more parallelism you can get. Now, when I've done this presentation, or a similar presentation, I have not actually done this presentation yet, outside of Microsoft, I've asked for a show of hands for how many folks have actually implemented a producer-consumer pattern before. So I'll try it here. How many folks have implemented a producer-consumer pattern before? All right, I'd say about half of the audience. How many folks here have implemented a Windows application before? Okay, excellent. And how many folks here, when implementing a Windows application, have had to deal with the fact that you offload some work to the background and you then try and get it back to the foreground or else you blow up? Same people. All right. So congratulations, you've all implemented a producer-consumer pattern. And the reason for this is, if, as Joe alluded to earlier in his talk, The UI thread in a Windows application is really, in effect, one of these producer-consumer patterns. It's being sent messages. It's the consumer that it's been processing, updating some state, rendering things to the UI, while you have these background operations, the producers, that's generating work that's showing back up in the UI thread. So we can see this fairly easily if I just, you know, take my handy thread pool here in my Windows Forms application. And by the way, I'm a framework guy, so my UI skills are about like this. Apologies. So I'm just going to sit in a background loop here, and my background loop is going to sleep for, say, a second, and then it's going to update a UI control. So say text equals date time offset dot to string. Now, I'm sure some folks in the audience are cringing. If I were to try and run this, the best thing that would happen is I would blow up. The worst thing that would happen is I wouldn't, and I would just be corrupting state all over the place. So what I actually need to do is take advantage of the, in this case, Windows Forms ability to marshal work back to the UI thread. So I'll create a delegate to actually run this operation back on the UI thread. And now if I run this application with my fancy UI, and I click go, we've queued up a work item, and now this work item is every second posting an operation back to the UI thread, which is consuming it. So this is actually a very typical producer-consumer pattern that you've all utilized, you just didn't necessarily know it. And I've actually already showed another producer-consumer pattern, and that is the thread pool. In fact, thread pool is itself a quintessential producer-consumer pattern. You, as the developer calling queues or work item, or the thread calling queues or work item, is the producer, and it's passing off, in effect, a delegate, the data, that's being passed off to the consumer, or one of many consumers, which are all the thread pool threads, which then pull from some queue. And there's typically always a queue involved in these producer-consumer patterns. There's a handoff point. It's pulling from the queue to process this data. So again, just to demonstrate that, just like we implemented our own parallel loop, and then I told you not to, we're going to implement our own thread pool, and I'm going to tell you not to. We'll do it anyway. So just to exemplify a producer-consumer pattern, I'm going to have a static class here. We'll call it my thread pool. And we're going to give this guy a queues or work item method that takes the work item. So now we have our producer, And now we need, as I mentioned, we need some handoff point, some way to do this. And because producer-consumer patterns are so common in parallelism and in parallel programming, and I mentioned we try to encapsulate these kinds of parallel patterns whenever possible, we've introduced a new type in .NET 4 called blocking collection, which if you've taken a data structures class or a concurrency class, this is a basically a blocking queue, in effect, but with some additional smarts around it. So my blocking queue, we're just going to call this actions and initialize a new one. And so all my producer is going to do is say actions.add and put the work item into this collection. Great. So now we have our producer. And every time you call queues or work item, it's putting the data into this collection. Now we need our consumers. And I'm going to make my consumers a bunch of threads that get initialized in the static constructor of my thread pool. So to do that, I'll spin up a few threads. Let's say I is less than environment.processor count. And I'm going to spin up a thread for each of these. We're going to make this a background thread and start it. And in the body of this thread now, I'm going to have to continually monitor for additional work, pull off the work, and process it. And because that is such a common pattern, and because I'd really like to be able to write a for each loop that says, for example, for each action in S actions, process the action, we've made it possible to get an enumerator from blocking collection that actually does this producer-consumer pattern, pulling from it and blocking if no work is available. So I can say sActions.getConsumingEnumerable, which if I look at this function, gives me an iEnumerable that actually modifies the collection as it consumes. And when I call moveNext on that underlying enumerator, it'll block until another item is available or until the collection is told that you won't get any more data, in which case the loop will just wake up. And now I've got my complete thread pool. So I'm going to go back up here, and I'll change thread pool to be my thread pool. And with any luck, we'll see the same results that we saw before, queued up a work item, and my background work processed it, and picked off the work item, and off we go. So this is a great example of generating a single item, handing it off to the background. But typically, your producer-consumer problems aren't this simple. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're more complicated. So as an example of something more complicated, I actually want to turn to something that I've actually faced in some real-world code that I've written, which is wanting to take some data and both compress it and encrypt it. Now, this isn't something that I can just use data parallelism for. I can't just say I want to take my input file and compress it and encrypt it, because I'm going to end up with one file that's compressed and one file that's encrypted, and neither the twain shall meet. What I really want is to compress it and then encrypt it. But if I do it all in one chunk, there's no parallelism there. Right? I'm just compressing and then I'm encrypting. So what I'd like to be able to do is compress a chunk, hand off that compressed chunk to the encryptor. The encryptor then encrypts it while I'm compressing the next chunk. And you get this kind of assembly line, producer-consumer, where data is moving from the input file to the compressor to the encryptor and the output. So I'll start off with a very simple example of this. I've got a little program here that's going to run my demo pipeline. I'll run this. And what's happening is I'm loading up a fairly large ISO file. It's about 500 or 600 megabytes. I'm opening up a file to write out to. And then I'm creating a compressor stream. That compressor stream targets an encryptor stream. And then basically I'm loading up from my input, copying to my compressor. My compressor's copying to my encryptor. My encryptor's copying to my output, and so forth. Now, if we look at my task manager, while this is running, we see that because this is this serial operation, I'm just using normal .NET streams, I'm only getting, well, sometimes less than a quarter of my CPU being utilized as I stall, but basically one CPU being utilized. And this should take about a minute to complete. Hopefully we're almost there. Well, while it's finishing, we'll switch away from this. And I'll talk about how we can parallelize this. So we've got our streams. We've got a compressor stream and an encryptor stream. And if you think about how I described this chunking that I want to do, we actually already have that to some extent in the .NET Stream class, right? With .NET Stream, you pass it a buffer, and it does something with that buffer, stores the data somewhere or outputs it somewhere. And you pass it another buffer and so forth. I'm, in effect, passing it chunk after chunk after chunk. Oh, here we go. We can see that my sequential implementation completed in about a minute. So what I'd really like to be able to do is insert a point here where my compressor can run on one thread, I have a transfer point, and then my encryptor can run on another thread. So to do that, I've implemented another stream. We call it a transfer stream. where it's going to take my encryptor, and that's it, and then instead of having my compressor target my encryptor directly, it's going to target my transfer. Now, if we look at transfer stream, keeping in mind what we saw with queues or work item and Windows forms and so forth, this is almost the exact same thing as the thread pool I just showed. It contains a blocking collection. When I call write on the stream, I take the buffer and I simply add, in effect, a copy of that buffer into my blocking collection. And then in my constructor, I spun up a .NET task, system.threading.tasks.task, which sits in a loop exactly like the loop that we saw with my thread pool, pulling off the next chunk to be processed and writing it out to the underlying stream. And this is that handoff point. Now I have a task running on a separate thread. My compressor task is generating data, handing it off to the transfer. The transfer is marshaling it to a different thread and then calling to the compressor, or to the encryptor, rather. So now if I run it and I bring up Task Manager, we can see that instead of using only 25% of the CPU, or between 0 and 25, now I'm fluctuating between 25 and 50%, taking better advantage of the system because I'm running both compression and encryption in parallel. Now, while this is better, this also does highlight a downside to producer-consumer and to these pipelines, which is that if you don't parallelize further the individual stages, you're in effect limited by the number of stages you have in your pipeline. Because if the pipeline, if the stages themselves aren't running internally in parallel, the only parallelism you have is the stages themselves running in parallel. So in this case, the best I could expect is a 50% improvement, which is coincidentally exactly what I got, taking 33 seconds instead of a minute and 6 seconds. All right. So that was a very quick tour through producer-consumer. If we could switch back over to the slides momentarily. There we go. I want to talk about another example, which are graphs of processing. Folks are familiar with graphs, right? You've got nodes, you have vertices and edges between the vertices. If you have a directed acyclic graph where there's no cycles that are happening, you can end up with something that's actually readily parallelizable. Take, for example, the Visual Studio project system. You have a solution. It contains multiple projects. And if it's a .NET, you might have references between projects in your same solution. So if I have project A, and project A references project B and project C, and project B and C don't have any other dependencies, I can build both B and C concurrently, but I can't build A until I'm done with both B and C. And that dependency is, in effect, the edge in one of these graphs. So if we take a look at my task graph example that I have up on the slides, I've got 8 projects. I've got 3 projects that don't have any dependencies, 1, 2, and 3. But then, it's hard to see in the slide, actually, but I think 4 has a dependency that's on 1, but you can only see the little arrow at the very end. And then 6 has a dependency on 3 and 4, 5 has a dependency on 2, 3, and 1. 8 has a dependency on 5, 7 has a dependency on 6 and 5, and so forth. And when you look at it this way, you can actually get a visual representation of what's parallelized, or what's actually able to be processed concurrently. And we talked with the pipeline example of how much concurrency was actually possible. We can do the same kind of analysis here with these task graphs, which is another sort of quintessential parallel pattern. It'd be nice if I could execute all 8 projects concurrently. Obviously, I can't. There are some dependencies. So we need to be able to figure out exactly how much concurrency is possible here. Just by shouting it out, anyone want to take a guess how many units we can process concurrently at best? 3? 4? Cool. All right. So, yeah, 3, 4, depending on what time in the cycle I am of my processing. What we can do to kind of further evaluate it is take a look at what the longest path through this is. So let's say that every node in this every vertex in this graph took 1 second to process. We might like to say that this could complete in 3 seconds. We might like to say complete in 4 seconds, 5 seconds, whatever it may be. We can figure that out by looking at what the longest path is through the graph. In this case, 7 depends on 6, 6 depends on 4, 4 depends on 1. So that I can't possibly do better than 4 seconds in this case. Now, in terms of, if we could switch back to Visual Studio, in terms of actually representing this, I'm going to switch over to another demo here, demo DAG. If we have our serial example, right, we can very easily represent this by saying build project 1, build project 2, build project, et cetera, all the way down to build project 8. before .NET 4, expressing this kind of parallelism, these kinds of dependencies, was a pretty challenging task, no pun intended. Maybe pun slightly intended. With .NET 4, we have the new task class, which enables us to express these dependencies between operations. So I can say, because projects 1, 2, and 3 don't have any dependencies, I just want to start them. And I get back a task that represents each of these operations. Now, project 4 depends on project 1. So once project 1 is done, I want to continue with the processing of project 4, and now I get back a task that represents project 4. Similarly, project 5 depends on projects 1, 2, and 3, so I can't do project 5 or build project 5 until 1, 2, and 3 are all done. Same for 6, I can't do 6 until 3 and 4 are done. I can't do 7 until 5 or 6 are done. I can't do 8 until 5 is done. So in almost the same amount of code with .NET 4, I've been able to express this DAG, these sets of dependencies, and then I can go off and execute it. And at the end here, I'm waiting, in this case, for all the tasks to complete, although I could simply just wait for 7 and 8, and that would be the have the same effect. So if I run this guy and I run it sequentially, we can see that each task is, in fact, taking 1 second. We can see that one's not starting until the next, and so forth. Now if I run it in parallel, now we were able to start 1, 3, and 2 all at the same time. As soon as the relevant subset was done, 4 and 5 could start, then 8 and 6, then 7. And you can see instead of taking 8 seconds, it took the 4 seconds that we predicted based on that longest path through this operation. All right. Now, these kinds of DAGs are useful for standalone kind of operations like this. You can imagine MS Build being implemented with a similar system. But there's actually a whole wealth of problems, programming problems, that can be expressed using this kind of DAG format. Could we go back to the slides? All right. So one kind of typical style of problem that you find if you take an algorithms class or other kind of computer science class are dynamic programming problems. This isn't dynamic programming like dynamic languages. This is dynamic programming where you're caching or memoizing individual results and using those cached results to compute further results. So one example of a dynamic programming problem is edit distance, where you might find something like this in a diff tool. You want to figure out how far away one string is from another string in terms of the number of adds or deletions or edits that you might require to go from one string to the other. So here I've got Steven, and I want to go from Steven to parallel. These aren't all that similar strings, but you can see that there's an E in both, and we might be able to take advantage of that E to minimize the number of operations I actually have to perform to figure out how far apart these things are. So in this particular example, I start off by saying, well, if I'm comparing Steven to, or each letter in Steven building up the string from top to bottom to nothing, well, adding an S requires one addition, adding a T requires two additions, adding an E requires three, and so forth. Or rather, deleting. So if I'm going from S to nothing, it requires deleting the S. If I go from ST to nothing, it requires deleting S and T, so that's two. Across the horizontal, we see I have parallel and the same thing. If I want to go from nothing to a P, I have to add one character. If I want to go from nothing to PA, I have to add two characters. From nothing to PAR, three. Then I can take this initial configuration, and I can start moving across to figure out what the individual cells are. So I can start, for example, by looking at what's to my left, to above me, and diagonally, and I run a little formula which basically says if the characters are the same, there's no work to be done, so just take the thing that's diagonally to my upper left. If there is a change to be made, take the minimum of basically what's to my upper left and above me and to my left and add one to it. So in this case, when I go from, when I try and fill in this cell, I see that P and S are not the same. So I take the minimum of the 0, 1, 1, I get 0, and then I add 1 to it, and now I end up with 1. Now that I have the 1 filled in, there are two more cells that open up for me to fill in. I can fill in these two guys, and then I can fill in these three, and then these four, and so forth. And you see I'm kind of progressing along the system in terms of the work that's now available to me in kind of a wavefront pattern. And in fact, this is called the wavefront pattern. You got to love the names computer scientists come up with. This is in and of itself a DAG. If you think of each of these cells as having dependencies from one cell, or rather, if I go backwards with a clicker, it's quite hard, actually. There we go. So this cell here has a dependency on the three cells around it, and then once I fill it in, the other two cells have cells on each or dependencies on each of the three cells around it, and so forth. And so I can build up a big task graph to represent this. So if we can switch back over to Visual Studio, I actually have this implemented, demo dynamic programming. We can see here in my dynamic programming problem, I've got the same algorithm I just described, where basically if the characters are equal, I just take the cell that was to my upper left. Otherwise, I add one to the minimum of the three cells around me. To do this in parallel, I have the same thing here, but I've got a little algorithm encapsulated called Wavefront. And if I look at what Wavefront does, it loops over all the cells. And if it's the first cell, the upper left, well, that one's easy to fill in. We can just do it right away. We don't have to wait for anything else because it doesn't have any dependencies. If I'm in either the top row or the side column, then I have a dependency on either the thing that was directly above me or the thing that was directly to my left. Otherwise, I have really two dependencies, the thing directly above me and the thing directly to my left. Now, you could argue that there should be a third dependency here. I'm actually taking advantage of the fact that I know that if both the thing above me and to my left are done, the thing diagonally is also done. So I've left that one out. But if I wanted to, I could have the third dependency listed here and just add it into this continuation, which says, don't do this piece of work until all of my dependencies are satisfied. So now I'll run this. If we bring up Task Manager, what I'm doing here is I've generated some random strings, I think about 13 or 15,000 characters in length, something like that. And then I'm running it serially and in parallel. And I think it's going to just repeat over and over. You can see that the serial implementation took about 10 seconds and the parallel implementation took about 3 seconds. So about a 3x, maybe a little bit better than a 3x speedup. And you can see when we switch over to the parallel, we do spike to take advantage of all the CPU. Now, again, we have to reason about how much concurrency we can reasonably expect. Right, in the pipeline example, we had multiple stages, and we were able to reason that unless each of the stages had concurrency internally, we were limited to the number of stages. In the DAG, we had to figure out kind of the longest path to figure out kind of our running time and kind of use the graph analysis to figure out how many nodes could actually be executing concurrently at the same time. In this case, if you think about it in terms of a DAG, and if we could momentarily switch back over to the slides, you can reason about it if you picture this in terms of it in sort of DAG form. At this point in time, there's only one potential thing I can do. So even if I have 16 bazillion cores, I can only do one thing. Now I can do two things, fill these in. Now I can do three things. So over the lifetime of this operation, I can't always saturate all of my cores, hence one of the reasons, or the primary reason why in the code example, we were not utilizing all the cores all the time. All right. So we've got about 7 minutes left, which I've reserved for questions since I did blow right through that. And I was told I had to stop on 45 minutes on the dot. So before people walk out, thank you for coming. And now I'll take all your questions.
Just a quick one for you. We saw the numbers for serial and concurrent. What's the impact on if you're running these concurrent programming examples on a single proc machine?
Great question. So I think everyone could hear the question, but just in case, if I write it to express all the parallels in my application, I take advantage of the parallel loops, I take advantage of the tasks and so forth, and then I run it on a single core box, what's the impact? There is some overhead, and we did our best to minimize the overhead as much as possible. We will look at the system and say, okay, you're running on a single core. We're not going to spin up additional work items. If you're writing the parallel 4, for example, we'll just run on the current thread rather than spinning up additional things. But there are some overheads inherent to the programming model. For example, we saw when I implemented my parallel loop that I was passing in the body of the loop as a delegate, right? A delegate invocation in .NET is approximately the same cost as a virtual method call. So every single iteration was incurring the cost of a virtual method call. Now, if the body of my loop is significant, as it was in the ray tracer example, it's negligible. But if the body of my loop was an addition, you know, one addition, the cost of that virtual method call is going to completely swamp the cost, and I would need lots of processors and lots of iterations to eventually make it up. So in that case, the overhead will be significant. If it's worth parallelizing in general, the overhead's going to be small, maybe a percentage, you know, a percentage point, maybe two. if it really got to be significant, typically you can architect some of these patterns where you could have a sequential version and a parallel version, but we typically argue you shouldn't have to do that. You should be able to express all the concurrency and let the system handle it for you, and we're certainly on that path. Whether or not we're 100% there now is probably very debatable. Any other questions? Another question.
How advisable do you think it is to use these patterns for consumer software?
Great question. How advisable is it to use this for consumer software? I'll turn it around and say, if you don't, and if you don't use this for consumer software, and your consumers go out and next year buy their new brand spanking new quad core or eight core, and those machines are becoming commodity, and they run your application, and it's only using 16% of the CPU or 4% of the CPU or 1% of the CPU, whatever it may be, they're not seeing a good return on their investment for buying the new hardware. Similarly, if you're not taking advantage of all these CPUs and you have a problem that could benefit from it, not all software does, but many problems do, you're giving up a whole lot of user experience by not taking advantage of that remaining 99% of the CPU that you could be used to do very useful operations. And sometimes, one of the patterns that I didn't talk about here but that can be really useful in things like consumer software are patterns around speculation, where I'm going to predict what I think the user is going to do. And as long as I can make that work throwaway, I can take advantage of these background processors that they have and predict what they're going to do something, and if they choose to do it, I can give it to them immediately because I've already computed it in the background using all their spare CPU. If they choose not to do that, throw it away. So an example would be something like an image editing program, where every time someone opens up an image, you see that they frequently run the same sequence of filters to kind of auto do the gamma and whatever else. You can just do that in advance as soon as they open it, and when they go to actually do it, have it available for them. So those sorts of things show up in games, show up in image applications, and many forms of consumer applications, including things like word processors, Visual Studio. You're doing all these background operations, spell checking, background compile, all that kind of stuff. You look at the kind of work that's being done in Office, for example, taking advantage of things like pipelining for loading files and background computation with things like spell check and grammar check and the like. There's a lot you can do in consumer software. So to come back to your question, I think it's really important. That said, as has been alluded to in previous talks and will be even more so in the testing and performance talks going forward today, it does open up a whole new bag of worms. And so it is something that you have to be conscious about when you start to adopt it. Don't just dive into the parallelism and waters and say, we're going to make everything parallel. The worst email I've received since starting on .NET 4 and since we released our first CTP was an email that said, I replaced all of my for loops with parallel for loops. My application is now broken. Microsoft broke my application. So don't do that. be very thoughtful about it and be very methodical about it. So if you're meeting your performance goals, and you've set your performance goals and you're meeting them without using parallelism, probably don't need to take advantage of parallelism. But if you're not, it becomes a really useful tool in your tool belt.
So I want to use parallelism in my enterprise application, and I am curious that if I can, should I use this new enhancements in the .NET 4, like Parallel 4 or tasks, or should I just use the old school, mutexes and signals, and is there a performance difference between those two approaches?
So I think in general the question is, there's two questions. One, should I use this in enterprise applications, and when I do use it in enterprise applications, should I use the old or new? And I would urge you whenever possible to use the new. There are a lot of performance advantages that come from using the new support. Things like the parallel for loop and so forth. Unless you create your own specialized parallel for loop that's tuned to your exact problem and takes into account the exact machines that it's going to be running on and so forth, if you're to do that, you probably could get slightly better perf, right? We've built a general solution. But it is a very good general solution that solves, the 90% case. And so, wherever possible, definitely reuse rather than rebuild. We spent a lot of time where it was appropriate using lock-free algorithms internally to minimize synchronization to make sure we had the scalability that we needed and so forth. We've tried to, as I mentioned, encapsulate a lot of these common patterns that you would otherwise have to write a lot of code to do. And we've tried to make it easy so you can just take it and use it. Things like the task class is actually deeply integrated with the thread pool, so it's not really an either-or choice. Use task. In fact, if you ask the CLR team, they'll say, Unless you really need to use the thread pool type directly for some specific reason, use task. Task internally takes advantage of new support that the CLR team built into the thread pool that only task has access to in order to, when you're running on larger and larger core counts machines, minimize the amount of communications that's necessary between threads and so forth. So in general, absolutely use the new stuff if it's appropriate. You know, against the gentleman's question, if it doesn't fit, don't try and fit a round peg into a square hole and so forth. But if you have a need for it, definitely reuse the new stuff rather than rewriting. That's not to say the old stuff isn't still useful. We haven't replaced everything. Monitor is still the bread and butter of locking in .NET, and you should still use it whenever you need a synchronization primitive to protect a critical section. Turn to monitor first and foremost, always. And then, if you find you have a specific need, branch out to read or write or lock or to spin lock or to whatever else it may be. One more question?
What happens with exceptions? So sometimes I want to terminate the entire thing if I throw an exception, and sometimes I want to recover and continue. And I definitely want them to be traceable so we can debug them.
Great question. So it was around exceptions. How do we handle exceptions? We tried to introduce a consistent story across the board. With the parallel loops and with parallel link, which I didn't talk about but Joe alluded to earlier, we have a mechanism whereby you're running a lot of things concurrently in kind of these fork join patterns. If anything has an exception, we will politely cause the system to shut down as soon as possible. Not your machine, but your operation. cause the operation to shut down as soon as possible. In the meantime, additional exceptions may have been thrown. So we'll gather all of those up, package them up into an aggregate exception, which we then rethrow on the main thread so that you have access to all the exceptions that may have occurred. In the case of tasks, tasks marshal their exceptions back to where they're waited on. So if you spin up a task and it throws an exception, when you later call wait on it, that exception is marshaled out of the wait point. Or if you're using a task of T that has a result, it'll marshal out of when you try and access its result. Now, we do try and accommodate both of those scenarios that you talked about. And those are difficult worlds to merge. Sometimes you want to crash, sometimes you don't. So what we do is if you have a task that had an exception, went unhandled, and you never observe it, we will then crash the application at some point later when we determine that you will never be observing it. And then we have a couple mechanisms for you to work around that. One is you can register an event handler that will be the final callback before we actually crash, and you can do something there. Or you can register continuations off of the task like we saw in the DAG, where you can say, I want you to run this continuation, but only if this task faulted. And if it faulted, give me the exception, let me do something with it. Cool. I'm getting the hook to be pulled off stage, so I'll stick around for a while off stage. But thanks again, everyone. This is great.